session number 11273, reel 2.
Major Kenwood, Reel 2. During this period, when you went to France, were you still with C Company at this time, or had you changed?
Yes, I had. I'd changed to the anti-tank company at 151 headquarters.
So this was it was a brigade unit rather than a battalion unit?
Yes, it was formed of three platoons, a platoon from each of the battalions.
And you took a platoon from 9th Battalion to it, did you?
Yes, that's right. Not a platoon, men from scattered, from companies who made up a platoon.
And what weapon were you issued with?
We weren't issued with anti-tank weapons, strange enough. There just weren't any two-pounders were we supposed to have. We had the portees. The portees, which carried them, which was just a big truck, a very big one, with ramps. Fitted in certain places. So we did the drills, marvellous drilling. We had one chap, in fact it was Maurice Kirby, who went on a course in England on the two-pounder. And he was from the 6th Battalion, he was another platoon commander in the anti-tank company. And he went on this course, and of course he then was our instructor, instructing us how to, all the drill and so on. And the drill was getting the damn thing on and off, this portee, a three-tonner portee. And the men as well, in with it, carrying us. And it was great fun putting the damn thing round, everybody crouching down, holding the right position of the gun that wasn't there, and lifting it up. And the men enjoyed it tremendously, not having a gun there. It was great fun.
What about actually firing, training in firing?
There was no hope of that, none whatsoever. There was no two-pounders available anywhere in the army.
So
at home.
You hadn't fired one?
No.
So this anti-tank company at 151 headquarters was purely nominal?
We reverted really to infantry use all the time. I told you about in France. I was really a platoon attached to the 9th Battalion, so the other platoons were attached. With our equipment, without the guns, of course.
Right, we'll go back to... You were on this retreat, and you'd lost your portees, I presume, when your transport went.
No, that isn't so. At some point or other, before the 10th of May, I went down to Army headquarters and collected some anti-tank guns. I collected 9 guns, but they weren't two-pounders. They were French 25mm, I think they were, anti-tank guns. I think they were about 25mm. Can't remember much about them. So we had to start training in the use of these. We trained on that before the balloon went up on the 10th of May. We trained on the darn things. And
what were they like?
Oh, they were very small anti-tank weapons. I think they had a split trail. I remember one of the chaps who was a cook in my platoon, a fellow called Graham, a big strong fellow, a miner. He used to pick the thing up and run, firing it. Of course, we hadn't any live stuff in at the time. He could carry the thing. He said, it's quite useless putting the thing down, opening this damn trail. You're losing time. And I can't remember much about it. It had a huge recoil on the barrel, recoil spring on the outside of the barrel. That's all I can remember about it. I remember firing it several times.
What was it like as a weapon to fire? Was it accurate?
It was accurate. It was rather short in range. And
how much range would you say?
Oh, we were supposed to fire it up to about 1,800 yards. But I don't think it was effective over 1,000. Yards.
So no more so than a rifle?
No. Very good penetrating properties, I believe, but very small, non-explosive. Just a blank bullet.
Had you, as an anti-tank company, had you come across the boys' anti-tank rifle?
Oh, yes, we'd always had that.
Yes. What did you think of that?
Well, it was a pretty useless weapon. I think it was very similar to the 25mm. Neither of them were very good weapons. And the boys was far too heavy to carry anyway. It should have been carried on something else. A poor chap who had to carry an anti-tank boys was in trouble. I remember particularly abroad somewhere, an officer we had then, a young second lieutenant, who was about 6'4" and about 16 stones, and offered to carry an anti-tank rifle while we were in the desert, I think it was, in Iraq, marching over the desert. He offered to carry this anti-tank boys. And the chaps were still the same sort of fellows that we'd had before, the miners. They had no, sir, not on your life, I'm not carrying your bloody stick. And the bloody stick, of course, was a huge mountain ash stick. This was the great fun against this big fellow. They wouldn't swap the anti-tank gun for his stick.
So, at this time, you had the 25mm French guns with you during the retreat.
Yes, we did, yes.
But you were saying that you were marching as well.
I mean, the infantry, that's what I remembered about it. The infantry were marching, and so were we generally, but we had the portees with the guns. Yeah.
And what happened next, then? You were on this retreat.
Yes, I don't remember what we did there. We stopped at several places, but suddenly we were put on the road again, and we knew where we were going from there onwards. This is about on the Belgian, back to the Belgian border almost, and it was to march to Vimy Ridge and take up defensive positions there, facing south. And we marched for 3 days, I think it was, solidly. People with bandages all over their feet and legs. It was a dreadful sight.
What state were you in?
Well, I was lucky because I had a 1500 weight truck of my own, and I was policing the whole convoy with anti-tank guns, that is, on the side roads and so on, putting the guns in position in case we were attacked from north or south as we went south, east or west. And I was using the 1500 weight most of the time. An 800 weight, not a 15, it was a small officer's truck. But whenever I possibly could, I got down and marched with members of the 9th Battalion.
What was the... Where had you learnt the principles of anti-tank, if you see what I mean? I mean, how did you know how to sight the guns to cover a line of march? Because that doesn't sound too easy.
Didn't I gun to... Oh, yes, of course, I went on a course. I went on a French officer's course on the anti-tank gun, on the two-pounder, which we never got. At a place called Grammont on the west coast of France during the slack period.
And do you remember what the principles were of covering a line of march? How did you go about it?
Oh, I don't think we were taught a great deal about that. I think the important thing about it was understanding the weapon, being able to take it apart and clean it and put it together again, and the various kinds of ammunition and the actual firing. And I must say, on the firing range, I did extraordinarily well. I got an A1, which was top of the bill on this. And I was the only English officer. They were all French, and it was in French. The whole instruction was in French.
So how did you cover the march? I mean, what...
Well, all I did was rush forward right to the head and talk with the officers and say, where are we going next? And I had the map and everything marked on. And I only had 3 guns, of course. I had to just place the 3 guns to the best of my ability on approaches.
So you just picked the spot that looked likely?
Yes.
Were they guns covered by anything? Would there be the crew? How many were there in the crew for a 25mm?
Oh, we had a crew as though we were on a 2-pounder, which is very much the same, I suppose. We had a number 1, the loader, and the aimer. Loader and aimer was one, and the firer was a corporal, a lance corporal, I think. And then we had 3 in the ammunition lift, backwards and forwards, and pile ammunition by the gun to go back and stand ready for more ammunition going. And we had a corporal doing that, and 2 men. We had a sergeant with each gun. And I think that was it.
Would any other troops be put out to cover the anti-tank gun, if you see that?
Oh, yes, we had 2 additional men with a Bren gun of our own. Each one was covered by a Bren gun. Yeah. Our own Bren.
So you were moving up towards Vimy Ridge.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that period? This is the 22nd.
Yes, that's right. I remember marching with my brother, who was commanding a company of the 9th Battalion, George, and he was in a serious state. His feet were both bound up. And I marched with him and helped him along as much as I possibly could on the way. But one peculiar thing I do remember is that we got an air raid from the directly head-on coming down this main road. And I had three guns out in position just beyond the main crossroads. And here were three planes coming fairly low. And I watched them and thought, crossroads, that's what they're for. And of course everybody was dispersing completely. And sure enough, they let go of the bombs and I watched them. The bombs came from in front of me. And I watched the bombs coming down. I stopped in the centre of the road. Everybody disappeared, of course, knowing that that bomb was going to land on the crossroads. And all three of them did, of course. One bomb from each plane, and off they went and disappeared. And somebody came out and said, "You're a bloody fool, sir. What the hell are you doing standing up the road?" I said, "But didn't you watch the bombs? Nothing to worry about if it's not going to hit you. You may as well stand and watch."
These were dive bombers, were they?
No, they weren't. They were just ordinary straight bombing. Small bombers and fighter bombers, I think.
They
I remember that.
They weren't machine gunning then?
No, they didn't. Well, they did, yes. They did machine gun the crossroads. You're quite right, they did. Because they'd dispersed their bombs before they got there, and in their one swoop, they did machine gun straight off again. Mm.
Did aircraft worry you like that? I mean, were they a worry?
No, they weren't. Not at that time. They weren't a great worry.
Were there any had refugees been a problem at any time? Or was that later?
Yes, they were a problem indeed. Fantastic problem. We had to fight our way through them. And I remember coming back through the village of Harai, I think it was called, near Ogondikor, to the small villages, where I'd been billeted, and seeing the atrocious, absolutely atrocious mess of whole households and children, women, men, carts, horses and so on, all destroyed on the sides of the road. Quite dreadful.
Right, so as you approached Vimy, you'd had this air attack. What happened next?
Well, the next thing was I got into my 800 weight and the three tonners arrived and picked everybody up, probably about 10 miles short of Vimy Ridge, and off we went. And then we came to a halt. Something was wrong, don't know what. I went to sleep, the driver went to sleep, and we wakened up to find nothing in front of us. So, of course, we just had to carry on the road, start up, and I went back to make sure nobody else was asleep as far as I could. I found one asleep. Anyway, off we went, and we were caught up by the MPs at the turn-off and so on, got slated by the brigade major and the staff captain, I remember.
But
we got our places. The brigade major was Major Percy, a regular DLI soldier, who later, within a week or two, came to command the battalion, and Fergie Simpson went off elsewhere. So the brigade, the staff captain, was he's a lord now. Lord Girdwood, Willie Fletcher Vane.
And was Churchill much in evidence?
Oh yes, indeed he was. One saw him wherever one went. Yeah, he was indeed a marvellous chap.
He was a good brigadier, wasn't
he? Oh, absolutely superb. You couldn't have wished for a better. A little bit elderly, but spry. And
what were his qualities, would you say?
Oh, understanding. I don't think I ever heard him give any orders. He came to ask how you were, what you were doing, where you were, why you hadn't done certain things, and understood everything about it. He's a wonderful fellow.
Right. So after you had been told off for falling asleep, you rejoined them. Where were they when you rejoined them?
They were on the We took up positions all the way along Vimy Ridge in the old Canadian trenches, They were already there when dug, in a pretty messy state.
From the First World War.
Yeah. But some of them had been concreted with sandbags. I know you've probably seen them. And we took up dispositions round about that and got ourselves shaved and washed in the morning. Nothing was happening.
What were you defending as an anti-tank company at this stage? Were you defending the brigade headquarters, or were you just put it as a tactical point?
Oh, and tactical, yes. Yes, each platoon was given to the battalion. I was always worked with my own battalion, the 9th battalion. And I discussed with the CO where he wanted the defences and what I thought about the defences, looking at the defence of the whole company, the whole battalion.
You'd be looking for a point where you thought that the tanks might come through.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
How would you work that out? I mean, what if you see what I mean? Because tanks could go almost anywhere. How would you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How would you work out? I mean, you didn't have many guns, only three.
Oh no, not many.
Italians.
Normally, we had two or three companies forward, and we'd disperse, perhaps one on each flank and one slightly to the rear and the centre. But we'd have to sight it in a place where we had a pretty good coverage, except that we didn't want the tank to see the gun. With long-range tank firing, we didn't want it. We only had a very small range of fire.
How would you conceal them?
Well, we used to get hull down somehow and fire across each other, in fact, in hull down positions, so that we had some support from sight, enemy sight of us. Because it was quite a noisy thing and quite a big flash.
Would you have any sort of camouflage, or would it just be that you were hull down that you...
We used camouflage as much as we could, yes.
What sort
We hadn't any netting, we just used any ordinary camouflage of twigs and branches and so on.
Natural foliage?
Natural foliage, yes. Yeah.
And were they painted in any sort of camouflage colour?
Yes, they were. Well, they were just a dull colour, a dull khaki.
So you set up these positions on Vimy Ridge, and what was the next thing you remember?
Oh, then, yes. We didn't get into any position that night. We just washed and shaved and made sure everybody was in good condition, looked at the feet and got them. We're all really behind the line. There was nothing in front of us, I didn't think. In fact, the main army headquarters had left this force, whatever we called it, I've forgotten the name. They'd left that, and there was nothing at all in front. Except, I believe, yes, the Tyneside Scottish, their brigade was in front, and they were being pretty well shot up and massacred, but it was a sort of fluid battle. Nobody knew what was happening. And then it was early morning before we really sighted ourselves, found out where we were, and the whole battalion sighted itself in defence. No real defence was assumed, I don't think, but just in case, it was a defensive situation. And we didn't actually use a defence there at all, never. The following morning we were pulled out to march into the attack further south at Arras. Arras had been army headquarters, and we were to attack round Arras, and we did that in two columns.
What do you remember about that?
It was a devil of a long thing. I think we had something like, 12 miles of road to march. We weren't very strong as a two-brigade division. And we had... I think we had the 8th Armoured Brigade with us, I'm not sure. Anyway, we went on two parallel roads. That's all I remember. Which roads they were, I can't remember now. But the 6th Battalion attacked on one, the 8th Battalion on the other, and my battalion, the 9th, came in reserve behind the 8th. And we had a long, hard march, and I had to... There were two of us, of course, the 8th Battalion ourselves. Chris Beattie was commanding the 8th Battalion platoon, and we took it between ourselves to hop on the defensive on each side. And we did this. It was pretty hard work going all the time.
What did you think of Beattie? He was doing the same job as yourself.
Well, he was a very young, very excitable lad. But... And we always called him the baby or the boy, and very excitable. But he's a nice lad. And later on, he proved himself to be a great officer when he got
more experience. But at that time, he was, from the sound of his nickname, he was a little inexperienced.
Yes, I think he was only 19 or 20, perhaps. And I think I was probably 26, 27 at that time.
So you were moving, you were leapfrogging forward behind the 8th,
yeah.
And the 9th bit was a reserve battalion. What happened then?
Oh, well, we got to the base of the whole attack, which was a village called Marriere. And the 9th battalion, my battalion, did a defence of Marriere. And I went into defensive positions with them. And then the following day, the 8th battalion, early in the morning, and the 6th battalion attacked on parallel lines. And they did very well. But unfortunately, the tanks really had infantry tanks and so on. They disappeared into the blue and did their own attack without infantry and carved up quite a lot of the German lines of communication. And
do you think, I realise you weren't forward with them, but do you think they'd have had more, from what you say, do you think they'd have had more impact if the infantry had stayed with the tanks? Or?
Oh, yes, I think they certainly would. The infantry went forward on its own as far as it could, but the tanks disappeared. There were French tanks, and I think the French tanks led on our own infantry tanks, and they just lumbered on. There was no connection. We didn't know how to talk to them. There was no communication.
Were tanks weak without infantry? I mean, I know infantry are quite weak without tanks, but was the reverse?
Well, no, I think they... there'd been nothing but training, of course, previously, but no warfare to talk of, and nobody knew anything, really. And the question of how to deal with tanks, how to use them, it took years before we got round to that. They acted on their own, just went their own way. And they all disappeared, and most of them got shot up, very few of them got back. And so the infantry went into attack by themselves. They were very successful. They got right through to the south of of the town.
Which town was it?
This was Arras. They got through to the south of Arras, but they were stopped, of course, and dive-bombed very heavily. And with an infantry assault, and they had to get out of it. And they were split between two villages. So, Jos Percy, who was then commanding us, who'd been brigade major, got the instruction to retire and go back to Lens, I think it was, as far as that, or back to the... I've forgotten now. I think it was Lens.
Now, what had you been doing during this? Had you been leapfrogging with Beattie behind this attack, or had you...
No, we'd stayed in Marriere, the base. But... My company commander disappeared on a motorbike. He was doing his own thing, doing his liaison to find out what was happening to the 8th Battalion. And he disappeared and we never saw him for a long time. He came back eventually. So I was really left in by my own, with my own platoon. He had been with me, of course, he was a 9th Battalion chap as well. And he disappeared. So I asked the colonel if, when the battalion moved back, I could let the tanks, the anti-tank platoon, go with them. And could I take a sergeant myself and my gun, my portees and whatever transport I had, to see what could be done to help the 8th battalion? And they came. He let me do that. And they came out of Wallace in a pretty dreadful state. They'd been... All three anti-tank guns had been knocked out for a starter, and their transport. And they came back very much diminished, and I helped them out and got them onto troop carriers and took them on behind the 9th Battalion. And we went straight up back up to onto Vimy Ridge.
Now, had you actually been in action so far in this, or had you just been acting in this support role?
Just in the support role, yes.
You weren't dive bombed at all during this?
Oh, yes, we were, yes, quite often.
How did you react to dive bombing?
Well, it was very, very frightening for the first time.
What was frightening about it?
Just the noise, I think.
The siren?
The siren scream, yes.
So that worked the first time?
Oh, it worked all right, yes, yes. Everybody went to ground, no doubt about that. There's no standing up, listening, watching those fellows. It didn't do any harm, I don't think, not a great deal.
Did you get used to the siren after a while?
I don't think so. No, I never did.
So it always...
It was a frightening thing. Mm. But we knew later on it didn't do the damage. We weren't terribly worried by it. except that the bomb coming down is always a bomb coming down. You never know what will happen.
So you pulled back up to Vimy Ridge?
Yes, we went back to Vimy. And got in defensive positions again there. And then I met my other brother by that time, who was commanding the force, Fusiliers, the Thunder Fusiliers. He was at Petit Vimy with divisional headquarters. And I met him when I went across there to meet somebody on the other side to discuss taking the guns over there. I don't know why, I can't remember the detail. But then my company commander disappeared on the motorbike again. He was a great fellow for swanning off. I think he was finding what the other, looking for the other platoons and the other battalion. He had to look at all three platoons. And I got hauled along to see the CO, and the adjutant was there, Big Bill Robinson. And he said, "Where the hell's Jackson?" If it's Vivian Horsfall and Jackson, of Jackson and Swinburne and Jackson, the solicitors and Gates, said he was my company commander. And I said, "I don't know, he disappeared." He said, "Well, you're in command on the ridge now, aren't you?" I said, "Well, I suppose I am." And in view of his absence, he said, "Well, I want one of your sections, one of your platoons down in the valley in this horrible little hamlet that was being shelled and machine gunned and so on. And the force fusiliers were there and the 8th Battalion was there under Ross McLaren. He was commanding as a major."
Which village was this?
The village of... I can't remember the name of the village now. It had a well-known name. I shall remember it before the end. So I went back and saw the other platoon commanders. And the very clever one of them said, "I'll tell you what we'll do." He said, "The first gun we come across as we go along from here, where we are now, first we go along the road, take the first left, wherever it is. The first gun we come across, whoever it belongs to, down in the village." I thought, this is Morris Kirby, who just died. So I said, "All right, Morris, you know exactly what you're doing." So did Morris. He knew what he was doing. They were all my guns along there, and he knew it.
So how come you hadn't known?
I did know. I wanted to go. I wanted to be the one away. And he didn't. So I said, "All right, Morris, we want one gun from your platoon and one from Chris's platoon. Get them, put them in my position, do what you can, I'm off." So I pulled them out and off we went. And we went through terrific shell stonks, shelling and air bombing, down to this village. And it was in an awful stench. Never met such a stench in my life. The whole village had been razed with all the farmers, the farm carts, the horses, the families, everything. And there was one shell hole I'd never seen the like of, the size of. Must have been a bomb hole. It was much deeper than this room and much bigger than this room. It was quite frightful. And I was getting the wind up as I went towards this village because there was nobody there, nobody in sight, not a sound. Absolutely deadly quiet. And so I stopped on the outskirts and we scattered a little bit and I walked down the village street with my sergeant to see if I could find anybody. And walking as silently as we could, not a sound to be heard anywhere. No shelling, no guns firing. And a voice shouted, "Halt!" So we halted. And here was a young second lieutenant, a fellow called Black, of the 8th Battalion, came out of a cellar under houses. Said, "What the hell are you doing here? Nobody's supposed to walk up and down the road. We've got it all covered completely." I said, "Well, that's very bad luck, Tom, but I'm here with some guns. What do I do with them? Where's the CO? He said, "Come on, take it to the CO." He swung the rifle over his shoulder and off we went to see Ross McLaren. He said, "Where the hell have you been? I've been asking for you for about 6 hours." Eventually we'd arrived. So he said, "Go and get your guns out behind the force, RNF. They're out in the woods there," and then I could hear the machine guns starting in the woods. So I did that. I went out there. And I said, what support am I getting? He said, get them out there and come back and see me. So I got them out there and came back and so on. And this was still before dawn. So we did that. Nothing really happened. There was no attack, but it was an eerie sort of sensation. And the 8th Battalion had been pretty hard hit at Wallace on the attack to Arras. They were in a pretty bad state. I thought they were a bit shattered.
I thought Beatty had lost his anti-tank guns at Walras, did you say?
Yes, he had. You're quite right. He hadn't any guns.
So you just picked up one from Horace Kirby.
That's right, yeah. Yes, I could have taken Beatty down. But, of course, Beatty had his own platoon still, and we had Bren guns, and he was in a defensive position with the 8th Battalion.
You were...
Oh, he was away. He was in this village with the 8th Battalion. He was a platoon, infantry platoon with him. He wasn't on the ridge.
Right, that's clear. That'll be...